Doesn't that computer know who you
are? Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Behold the glory that is
me. A little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact same thing.
I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my friend?
Onto a Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah.
This is Tech Talk.
Good morning. Yeah, this is Tech Talk. I got me, Michael Tech Talk Kassler, and I think, do I hear him? Do I hear him on the other line? Dave Sparky Saganaki? Oh,
everybody.
Oh, there he is. There he is. Okay. All right. It helps. You know, what helps to hear you is when I actually, you know, turn the volume up. I'm so used to bringing the volume down on you that I went.
Actually, I was. Oh, you're used to. Oh, I see. I'm too loud. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, you just, you know, just right in there talking too loud. I don't know.
I'm sorry. Well, you know, I've got a headset on. I can't back off the mic very easily. I have to like swing it around like that. How's that? Is that better?
No, I was kidding. The more Dave, the better. That's what I say.
Really?
I think everybody feels that way that listens to the show regularly knows.
right. Hey, I hope you're feeling better. Off air, I could hear you while you were getting ready, sniffling and coughing and such.
Yes. You know, I've been battling a bit of a head cold the last week or so. And apologies to listeners who were very excited about last week. Missed the show. I just couldn't do it. I was just floored by the same thing that pretty much everybody's got right now, it seems, is this Midwestern, just a nasty, nasty cold. I'm pretty much better. And fortunately, we're in luck, was the guest I was so excited about bringing on last week agreed to just shift a week. He's coming on today. John Miley from Kiplinger's is going to talk with us about net neutrality. We're a week away. They're a week away in Washington from deciding the fate of net neutrality. So this is a great time to talk about it. We're hitting it right on the button. It works out well.
We could always use more information about these types of issues.
Absolutely. I think sometimes it's very easy for us to sort of just, you know, listen to the hype of one side or the other, or, you know, take a cursory glance at something and think, well, yeah, I like that, you know, and you're behind it and all this. It's always good to dig a little bit deeper, find out some of the more in-depth information and make our own decisions about stuff. I think John's going to help us do that and make some good decisions about it. I don't know exactly where he stands with how the legislation is today. I know you and I have had some discussions and a little back and forth about it. So I'm excited to get a little third party info here.
I'd be very interested to have to find out what he has to say.
Yeah, well, we'll do that in just a little bit, and we'll keep you on air for that. And of course, we're going to have our good friend Jay Garman on in just a couple minutes as well. In fact, I'll try to bring him on fairly early, and that way, then we can kick into our interview fairly early and move on from that. But boy, it's. it's been a big week. It's been a big 2 weeks, but even just this last week, there's just been a huge amount of stuff going on in tech. Did you hear about this superfish thing that's been going around?
I heard about it, but I don't want to talk about it because it makes me hungry for fish.
Not just any fish, superfish. Yeah, exactly. Not only that, but yeah, not only does it make you hungry because it's a superfish, but you know, one of the SDKs that they use to create it, which is a software development kit, is called the SSL Decoder Digester. So, you know, you can digest the superfish.
So let's explain to folks what that is. That's Lenovo computers, you know, their laptops shipped from like September through December. They've shipped with this software on there, which is basically a man in the middle attack that substitutes. When you go to a website, you know, there's certificates that let you know that they're verified certificates. And Lenovo's put a software in there that instead of verifying the certificates, they substitute their own certificates, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
Is that it?
Yeah, exactly. And the entire point of it, I guess, was to allow for these ads to be injected into any website that you went to. And,
right.
You know, it was done for just to put money in their pocket, basically. And as is so often the case, was just done poorly and left things wide open. Yeah, one of the problems with it was not only did they create these certificates, so these certificates are ways that our computer and our access to the internet, that we know that we're going to some place that is legitimate and is true. So, you know, if you go to Associated Bank or whatever, you get a certificate from Associated Bank before you log in that tells your computer you can verify that site against a third party external source and say, okay, yes, indeed, they have the right certificate. This is the place you're supposed to be, not some fake. What the
VeriSign is the big company, right? Is one of the bigger companies that provides that service.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And so, as you said so well, you know, the Superfish, what it does is it sits in the middle of that and puts its own certificate to a third party place. And so it, you know, it's very easy to hack. Also, too, the other thing that they did was they didn't generate new security keys for every computer, which is typically what you would want. And I mean, which is what you do with this type of security. They used the exact same key, the exact same connection piece for license for every single one, for every single computer. So all that the hackers had to do was hack one of those and they could hack everybody. So
yeah, it's very unsafe. And also it's been traced to other, and not just Lenovo computers, but other software applications. It came from a company called Comodia, which is an interesting name. The Israeli Comodia, a company called Comodia, and they also make other software that helps parents monitor their kids online, that sort of thing.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. They have Keep My Family Secure is one of their products, and I've seen that. They also used or have created the Curapira web filter and Custodia. Custodio. I'm sorry.
Custodio.
It's spelled
with
a Q. I haven't seen that one, but
But I guess all this concern about it kind of crashed their website. They took down their website because there's so many people were trying to contact them and complain or find out more about it.
Yep. Now, there are a lot of ways to get rid of it now, which is great. And in fact, Microsoft was being given some kudos because they were one of the early ones that stepped up and said, here's how you get it out. Go to our site or download our security software and it'll just blow it out and you'll be done with it. You can also go to PC World's got a great little article on how to manually get rid of it. One of the problems, of course, is that even if you remove Superfish, those security certificates are still there in your system and could still be hacked, even if the software itself is gone. So it's definitely a concern. Now, and like I said, now those you can get rid of. There's ways to deal with it and be done with it. But did you hear about Equation, the Equation Group?
No, I have not.
Oh, boy. Now, this is insane. I have not heard of this type of a malware hack being this ridiculous. The only way that you can stop this super advanced malware, if you indeed have it on your machine, is by putting a spike through your hard drive.
I remember that quote.
It's impossible to remove. It's literally impossible to remove because it goes and drills right down into the root of your hard drive kernel, your hard drive operating piece, and so it's just so
what's
even,
that called, the master boot record or something?
Yeah, there's
remember.
The master boot record
way down.
But the thing is, they don't even hit that. So your MB, that's like your MBR, and you can do stuff with reformatting to hit that, but there's actually your hard drive has a hidden storage sector, and that's part of the hard drive's firmware. So the hard drive's firmware is being used to create these hidden sectors on the drive, and those can only be accessed through what they're calling a secret API, application programming interface. So it's bad news.
You know, never mind talking about net neutrality. We should talk about net neutering.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
We got to get this fixed.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what that's why, you know, just do everything on the cloud like me. That's I think that's the way to deal with it.
Oh, yeah. That's there's not going to be any problems with that.
I just reinstalled my whole computer. It took me about 45 minutes the other day. I just redid everything. Again, going to Linux. The problem is I put in Linux Mint, as you know, six months ago maybe. But I put in version 15. It wasn't the most current or up-to-date one. It was Mint Cinnamon. It was fine. I was excited. I was happy about it. But at that time, Mint was not developed enough to automatically update with new updates and so on. And so I was not able to successfully get it to the newest flavor of Mint, which was 17. So I had to blow it all out, start all over again. Like I said, it's so easy to do these things these days. 45 minutes. Took a USB drive, another computer so I could load the ISO on it, and, you know, whiz bang, and I was done. And by 45 minutes, I don't mean 45 minutes to install the operating system like it takes with Windows. I mean 45 minutes to not only get the Windows or the Linux operating system installed, but to also configure everything up exactly like I had it before and how I was using it, and make some small tweaks and performance improvements too. And it runs much faster. I'm very happy with 17. I actually didn't go to Mint. I used Mate, which is a flavor of the Linux Mint system, and I'm very very happy with it.
Cool. You're such a geek. Speaking of geeks, and you wanted to bring him in early.
Let's bring him in right now.
How about Mr. Garman?
Yeah, that's a good idea. So let's see. Yeah, what am I doing here? I gotta figure out how to bring him on again. Yeah, every week. You'd think I'd have like a whole system for that. Maybe I should build a shortcut. You know, that's probably the better way to do it.
Yeah, you can totally redo your computer in 45 minutes. It takes you about that long to figure out the board every week.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I don't know why that is. I really don't. There's something broken, Dave. It's me.
It's just too analog for you.
Oh, I don't know. We used to say, you know, it's either an ID10T error, which you know, write that out and you'll understand what I'm saying, or a problem exists between keyboard and backup chair. Hey, good morning, Mr. Garman. How you doing, sir?
Not too bad. How you doing, Mr. Kassler?
Not too bad. I was excited to find out that my computer does not have the equation malware on it, so I don't have to put a spike through my hard drive.
Well, so far as you can tell.
Yeah, well, and if I can't, Hi, Jay, welcome if I can't tell, program, I don't bro. Care. You know, it's...
Glad to be here, Dave. And how's the Corvette?
Well, yeah. I haven't picked it up yet. It's still at the dealer because it's too snowy to move it.
Nothing like a car you can't drive.
I was gonna say that is an issue. So yeah, no, this is a legitimate thing here for people that are listening. Dave, who lives in Canada, where there's about I'd say 7 weeks of you know, clean driving weather during the year
at best. Yeah,
yes. Well, I suspect that most of our listeners know Canada by its more common name, the planet Hoth.
Yeah. Exactly. So he's investing most of his life savings in a car that he can use for 7 weeks out of the year. So I
no, I could go in the garage and sit in it once in a while.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Exactly.
That's true. No, Fox
told us having is not so nearly as pleasing as wanting. So as long as he wants to drive it, he's good. It's when he gets to drive it that all the fun wears off.
This is true. Yeah, if you had to drive it, even if you were driving it every day for like an hour commute or something, you'd be so sick of it after you know.
Oh, sure.
Three years. It would just.
Have you ever been in a Corvette? Trust me, you won't. Yeah. And I loved Kassler's idea about putting moose antlers on the front. That's great.
Well, if you're getting that silver one though, too, a big red maple leaf on the side, I think, you know, would be kind of sweet. And you know, flame it up though. Red maple leaf with the flames flying out the back. I'm already getting I'm getting kind of envious just of that.
It's a chick magnet, definitely.
Definitely. Now, interesting though. So we were talking about the autonomous cars, and you're worried about, you know, the is the value going to die? You know, when people bring in all the auto cars. Well, there, I don't know if you heard about it, there was a 14-year-old. He went to the blowout sale, I think, at Radio Shack, now that Radio Shack is dead, and bought up $15, which, you know, was basically the entire store that was left, and $15 worth of equipment, and was able to hack into his car, take over the car, honk the horn, open the doors, light the lights, and do everything else he wanted to.
Well, yeah, because they're investing absolutely nothing in automobile security at all. That was, you know, so I drive by a very large car lot every day when I take my kids to school. It's one of those dealerships that has like 17 imprints, you know, Jeep, Dodge, Honda, Volkswagen, Fiat, DeLorean, you know, all together. And they've got up on the big spinners all the new GMC vehicles. We have Wi-Fi. I'm like, yeah, and I bet you don't have any encryption at all in that car. it's just got a SIM card and a dash, and it hopes for the best.
Yep. That's exactly right. Well, there's a cyber auto group, and one of the lead scientists, a guy named Anuja Sonalka, he said that... security has been built as an afterthought in all right. industries, and that includes, of course, automobile. What they have now is every vehicle has got a controller area network. So, of course, you know, they got to have their own acronym for everything. It can't just be, you know, you've got your network for your car. It's a controller area network. And so this 14-year-old, he built a bunch of devices. He wirelessly communicated and hacked into that and was able to not only did he like unlock the car, you know, turn on the headlights and the window wipers and everything else he wanted to. He also too engaged the remote start feature, which a lot of cars have got now. this kid was ready to roll. No more breaking windows. Nobody's got to break windows anymore. $15 and hire your local 14-year-old and you're done.
So what really scares me about this, and we've talked about this a little on some previous programs for the six listeners who've listened more than once, Google has their self-driving cars, and I suspect Uber's going to do the same thing, is they get hyper-accurate maps of... So in Mountain View, California, they have it mapped down to like the quarter inch where everything is, and they constantly re-update them. So the car doesn't have to do any actual territory mapping. It just uses its radar and LiDAR equivalents to see where objects are on the map, and that's much less processing power. But the thing is, you have to update the map. You know, Mountain View does road construction. Things, you know, they put a new sign, they change stoplights, they put in a turning lane. So that's going to be firmware that gets updated. And what terrifies me is the notion of someone being able to corrupt that firmware and, I don't know, remove a stoplight from the map so the car doesn't even think to stop. That's the kind of thing that's going to happen. It's like, or they don't even have to hack it. I mean, bear in mind, these are giant mega corporations who don't... At a certain scale, when you have 10,000 employees, at least two of them are going to be terrible, just statistically. Even if you have five nines of good hiring,
two?
When you get to the size of GM or Toyota, some of them are going to suck. You just you can't. And one of them could eventually be the person who does those maps, and they're just going to forget, like, we accidentally flashed your firmware with a 1998 map of Mountain View, California, when that one bridge wasn't there.
Yep.
And just horrible things are going to happen.
Yep.
Garmin, you're such a Luddite.
Oh, I totally am. Well, I say this knowing that when you have a GPS that's talking to you, we already have people every year that, like, drive into lakes and off of, like, drawbridges because they just listen to the GPS and don't pay attention. How much worse is it going to get when they don't ever have to pay attention and the car is doing everything and you don't double-check what the car is doing? It's like, hey, we're now turning on to Walnut Street. Wait, Walnut Street? It's been Walnut Street since 1955. Because now it's called Muhammad Ali, and now it's one way.
Well, and not even, I mean, not even the people that just like aren't paying attention and just drive off bridges and so on. But there's been a number of cases where some incorrect GPS information has led people off of main roads and literally gotten completely and utterly lost and stranded in the middle of the desert. in Nevada and Arizona. And, I at least in one case, I think it led to, if not a death, certainly some hospital time and other things. Because just you're following the GPS and it says to go this way. And then all of a sudden you realize this ain't really a road. This is I'm just driving on dirt. Yeah. And now there's nowhere to go.
If you've been through Ohio, it's not that different. But
this is true. Hey, some areas of Kentucky aren't that much better, buddy. So
yeah, this is true. Well, I mean, we have shoes. We don't always have paved roads.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. I think there are some definite challenges, and this definitely brings some of that up. I was sad to see, though. At least I was happy, though, to see that there still is a place for Radio Shack. At least in this one teen's life, he'll have a memory of that that'll last him his life. I was really torn about Radio Shack falling and truly being certified as dead and gone. My first real quote unquote real job was at a Radio Shack up in Minnesota at Cedarville Mall, for any of my Minnesota peeps that are listening, and with Phil and Earl selling Tandy 1000s and the cocoa and helping people decide whether they wanted to invest in that spiffy new Betamax. Or was the VHS the better thing to do? And by the way, I've got a whole rack full of laser discs I could also give you too. You know that.
Hey, don't make fun of the laser discs, because that is the only place you can get even remotely a digital copy of the original unaltered Star Wars trilogy.
Wow. That's,
if you ever find a DVD of the quote digital unaltered, it's they've ripped it off a laser disc. That's the only time. It still wasn't entirely unaltered. Like, I couldn't go into the details. There are slight differences in the cut, but it is before he CGI'd the crap out of it in 1997.
And I often look back, and I mean, you know, I worked at Radio Shack, so I had a discount. I got, you know, stuff and all this. My dad was big into Laserdisc. He was ahead of his time. He knew this was a better system, you know, at least as far as the quality went. We had like milk crates full of these laser discs, but of course, you know, everybody was so dumb, you know. It's like all of a sudden it's like those were dying, VHS was coming in, so what do? We put them in a garage sale, you know, a nickel a piece. And boy, if we had for some reason held on to those as you know, which of course each milk crate to these things are ridiculously heavy, you know, it'd be like 300 pounds each milk crate, but if it somehow figured out a way to hold on to these, it worth tons of cash now. So
you have to wait out the hipsters. I mean, that's the thing about this. You've got to be patient enough for it to become ironically fun.
Yes.
As opposed to just obsolete.
Hey, I got to move on. I want to bring John Miley in. I want you guys to stick around. But Jay, we got to do our business. We got to get, there was a Valentine's, St. Valentine's disorder that I wanted to hear about. And then we got to find out what we're talking about for next week too.
Right. So, we asked 2 weeks ago, in anticipation of the Valentine's Day show, that Mike was sadly ill for, but he did not have St. Valentine's malady. There is a tradition in Italy and other parts of Europe, but largely in Padua, Italy, of giving St. Valentine's keys to children before the age of romance to help ward off St. Valentine's malady. So the question is, what was St. Valentine's malady? And the answer is epilepsy. Hmm. So St. Valentine is the patron saint of romance, which led to an association with hysterical fainting, as romantics often are, which then led to him, somehow, as only Italians could probably do, associating him with epilepsy. You are so in love, you go into a seizure. St. Valentine's malady, he is the patron saint of romance, lovers, and epileptics. I'm not making this up. And you can, in certain parts of Italy, notably around Padua, receive a St. Valentine's key to unlock the romance in your heart and ward off fear of epilepsy.
Huh. Now, how was a key supposed to help you ward? Because when you first were saying keys, I thought, hey, I wonder if it's like an iron deficiency or something like that. You know, giving you an iron key that you can.
I really
mix your stone
don't think it was anything other than raw superstition. The best guesses they have, and I poked around this a little bit. It's very much related to silver spoon. So the notion. By the way, we have bonus trivia here. The notion of giving a child a silver spoon is silver does actually have some nutritional properties, and so rich folks you know, back before we had pacifiers, children sucked on spoons. Mm-hmm. If you had truly had a silver spoon, there was a notable improvement in your childhood nutrition if that's what the infant sucked on. So there's some sort of association with precious metals warding off disease. That's
well,
sort of
I was
going to
say,
genesis of it. So
yeah,
if you give a child an object of precious metal, you are trying to ward off disease. I don't think there's any actual direct, like, I don't think there were lithium in the keys or anything.
Yeah,
It's just sort of superstitious.
Well, and I think actually, I wonder if it's not a nutritional thing, but I know that silver ions can counteract some, it's almost like an antibiotic effect on some infectious diseases. So, I never really thought about that or made that connection. That is very interesting. That's very interesting.
Incidentally, the same reason why silver is supposed to ward off vampires and werewolves, it is known for being, so having some sort of medicinal benefit being in physical contact with silver, unlike gold. So that is also where those legends of, you know, vampires and werewolves being warded off and evil spirits being warded off by silver.
Very, very cool. Very cool. So, outstanding. Of course, we had a nice response from customer Jones. Just to remind people, you can go to facebook.com/techtalk WRLR or tweet us, you know, Twitter, Tech Talk WRLR. There's a lot of different ways to find us to answer the questions. And Jay is going to ask us the next question now for next week that you can respond to anytime you want to.
So on February 28th, 1953, Watson and Crick confessed to a group of their friends that they had cracked the structure of DNA, and this time they got it right. And they then went on to submit a paper to the journal Nature, which was published on April 2nd. They made a formal announcement on April 25th, which is the date everyone knows, but this week is the actual anniversary of them telling anybody that they actually had gotten it right. Which is important because they had previously gone to the trouble of bringing everyone at King's College in London around to show their original model of DNA, which was horribly wrong. So the question for this week is, before they got it right with the double helix on February 28, 1953, what structure did Watson and Crick originally propose for the composition of DNA?
Oh, that's a great question. I have no idea. That is, that's awesome. That's awesome. And good.
For
and
you
good
biochemistry
time
nerds, they were not alone in being wrong. The same wrong structure was also suggested by Linus Pauling.
Man. Yeah, well, and I do remember reading somewhat recently a little bit about the history of that and them struggling through, and that also to the way that they arrived at that new structure was kind of scoffed at by a lot of the current scientists of the time. But we'll talk about that next week. I'm going to bring on John Miley here, who I told him, oh, I'm going to bring you in super early today, John, because we have too much. And of course,
I tell you, Mike, I got to step off. I got to take my kid to a birthday party, so I sadly cannot stick around.
All right. Well, hey, Jay, it was great having you on. Sorry to have you go. Have fun at the birthday party, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right. Have a good one, fellas. Yep.
Take care, Jay.
Take care, Jay. Thanks.
Bye.
Jay Garman, jaygarman.net. You can always get more from him. And I've got John on the line right now. John Miley, you with us?
Yes, I'm with you.
Ah, fantastic.
Welcome, John.
I've got Dave with us as well. As promised, apologies. I knew this was going to happen. It always does. Is I always think, oh, I'm going to do this really fast today. I'm going to be so efficient. And then all of a sudden it's, you know, 5 minutes before the show's supposed to end and I'm finally bringing our guest on. But please take no offense at this. It has nothing to do with you, John. I'm so excited to have you on to talk to us about net neutrality. Let's start, though. Tell listeners, if they don't recall from the last time you were with us, a little bit about who you are and Kiplinger's as well.
Sure, yeah. I'm a associate editor at the Kiplinger Letter. We're based in D.C., so I have been really close to whatever's happening with net neutrality. Our newsletter is sort of a business forecasting newsletter, but we also have our monthly personal finance magazine that's probably more widely known.
Yeah. And I know you've given me some copies of Letter, and I've seen it before too. And it's just, they do really do a great job. One of the main focuses, I know, both for the financial side, but also the other pieces, is kind of bringing that together to allow people to make better decisions with their money, because it almost like forecasts a lot of the changes that are going to be happening, not just in technology, but other areas too. This change in particular, though, is just going to have this huge, huge, wide-reaching impact for everybody, whether they realize it or not, whether they're a wonk about tech or politics or not. Everybody's going to be hit by that. Is that a fair statement to make?
Yeah, that's the way I would see it, because the FCC, they're going to vote next week, next Thursday, on new net neutrality rules, and it would basically implement a new mode of regulations on internet services and broadband services and even cellular services that we don't have today. So I agree with what you're saying in terms of it's definitely a shift from what we've seen for the past decade or so.
Yeah, and of course, you know, it's interesting in so many different ways. Maybe we should start with trying to give like a real basic understanding of what the debate is even about. I think people have heard of net neutrality, but you know, just to clarify, and here's my layman's take on it. This is what I hear repeated so often in the media, is that net neutrality is about providing fair and open internet access. As Wheeler, Tom Wheeler says, who's the chairman of the FCC, he says, fast, fair, and open. That's what he wants to see happen with the internet. By applying these new regulations, they're giving the FCC the power to enforce that desire, essentially, on this. And you read that and you listen to that and you think, well, of course, that makes sense. That we shouldn't hamstring companies. You know, everybody should have access to this. It is, in the sense that Barack Obama wants to say that it is, President Obama, it is a utility level service at this point in our lives, you know, for those that live and breathe on the web.
Yep. Yeah, no, that's the way. I mean, some of the specifics is, it would be internet providers, they can't block lawful content, they can't slow it down, they can't charge you extra for certain websites and all that. And that's, I mean, when people think about Facebook and Netflix and other sites that ride along internet pipes, that it makes a ton of sense. You want to keep it an open internet for all these different things. But when like you said, I was looking at the timeline for the debate on net neutrality, and I was like, well, I can't go on for hours. it's been around, they've talked about it for a decade. I guess I could go back, 2010, the FCC voted on open internet regulations.
Yep.
And that sort of put something on the books. Before then, Chairman Powell, I think in 2005, had some open internet principles. So people have been talking about why this is a good idea, keeping the internet open. But in 2010, they voted on something, and it had the no blocking, the transparency, and no unreasonable discrimination. Those were thrown out by the court in January 2014, last year or so. And the court said the FCC does not have authority to do this in the way they're trying to do this. So that sort of brought us to where we are now, which is what you're talking about. Chairman Wheeler, there's three Democrats on the FCC commission, then two Republicans. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's clear to say they're going to vote to pass these rules that he's come up with. They're going to, it's called reclassify the internet. Instead of a lightly regulated service, it's going to be the jargon word Title II, mm-hmm. which is a much more strictly regulated, it's a common carrier utility type service. So that's their plan. And hopefully that sort of gets us to where we are now. That's where we are now.
Yeah, and so this Title II, these laws have been in place since, 1934, I think I read, with modification, admittedly. But it's a little scary to think that we might be applying some of these telecom and other utility type rules that were developed by people nearly a century ago. Now, I mean, it's crazy. Over 70 years ago to things they could have had absolutely no conception about.
Yeah. And that's what cable companies, internet providers, Republicans and others, that's the concern they're voicing, mm-hmm. that these are a whole lot of new regulations that we haven't had. They're worried it could sort of slow investments in our networks.
Mm-hmm.
But what Chairman Wheeler would say is, hey, we're picking and choosing only a few of these Title II of these utility type regulations. We're only going to pick a few of them. And once we can reclassify the internet to this, then it will give the FCC authority to implement net neutrality. So that's where it sort of gets confusing. What he's doing is reclassifying it, but that's not net neutrality. Net neutrality would be afterwards just saying we're using these new rules and this new authority to do that. And that's what they did not do in 2010 when they voted on the open internet regulations. They were still trying to do light touch net neutrality regulations, but the court said, look, if you're going to do all this, you can't do it under that light touch authority. You would have to do it under what he's trying to do now.
So it's more almost about giving the actually adding some enabling power to either the government or the individuals, the companies affected, to be able to enforce this, to actually say, this is what we want. Right now, there's not much we can do if you're not actually following these rules. So we're going to add some language and put it into a different classification. And now we can actually come down on you and make it happen.
Yeah, now we can do this. And I think that there hasn't been, I know there was a Comcast was slowing down BitTorrent. That was one of the issues. But up until now, there hasn't been many cases where net neutrality has been a problem for internet service providers. So mm-hmm. So that's one of the things they would argue.
Yeah.
And they're also, I mean, they're worried about, talk about all these new types of regulations, the potential for even more, because once you have it under this authority, you could sort of add all these other regulations as well. So, there's a lot of concern. And the other thing I would point out is they are voting next week, but I think that this is going to take at least 2 years, probably till after Obama leaves, uncertainty. So there's going to be lawsuits against it. They're going to try to work it out. So it certainly doesn't end this debate on this, on net neutrality.
Well, and since you bring up the topic of lawsuits, I think that's one of the stronger arguments against the current legislation that I've heard. One of the commissioners who's on the FCC is a guy named Ajit Pai, and he has actually been very vocal in speaking out against the current plans. And one of the things that he said is, and this is a direct quote from him, is that he says that Mr. Wheeler's proposed rules amount to a gift to trial lawyers because of course you've got this language, just as in any sort of legal document, you've got this language including business practices that are not deemed just and reasonable by a plaintiff.
Yep.
So, you know, working through that language and, taking it from this rather vague, nebulous, if well-intentioned wording and making it something enforceable is going to require, as you just said, a tremendous amount of effort and time and legal expense probably on all sides to work that through and make it reasonable. And that, of course, is going to result in what? A higher cost to us directly.
Well, I think this is a good point, too, because this gets to, I think, what most consumers are interested in. They want faster internet, and they probably might not be happy with their service, and mm-hmm. they would say the cost is too high.
Mm-hmm.
I would say if that's what you're thinking about with this, I don't think this directly impacts that. I don't think this sort of adds to competition. It might even reduce competition a little bit, because I think it's going to be hard for really small internet providers to do all these regulations or to do, I think eventually it could, at least it imposes some uncertainty.
Yeah.
So if you were, I just hope that people don't think of this as, they are doing other things to try to address the competition and cost issue, but the network neutrality is sort of a separate issue from that. And if you look ahead into the future, there's some interesting things going on there. But I think that's partly, you don't want your Netflix or Facebook blocked or slowed. But I think that most people are concerned about the cost and speed that they have access to. And of course, a lot of people, especially when you get to the higher speed tiers, they really only have one choice of wired internet to their homes.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was going to say, is I wonder if the focus here is just in the wrong thing. They're putting all the focus here on, protecting on the kind of production side of it, if you look at it from that aspect, as opposed to on the delivery side. And, wanting to protect those producers of internet content versus saying, hey, we need to do something about the fact that in order for people to enjoy high speeds at a reasonable cost, it's not really working well that you only have one provider in your area. As you say, I ran into this myself. In our area, it's Comcast. I can go with the DSL speed from AT&T. Or I can get wired internet with Comcast. I hate it that I have to spend an arm and a leg with Comcast. I'm a cord cutter, so I don't have any cable. I don't have any TV. I don't do anything else through Comcast. But I absolutely need that higher speed, that higher tier. There is no place else for me to go to get it. And I'm not going to speak badly about Comcast one way or the other or well, but it just, for me as a consumer, it's frustrating because I can't even judge whether the price that I'm paying is appropriate for my area because I only have one place that I can go to. And this does not address that at all.
Yeah, the FCC is doing something to help. They want to help some states to do some nonprofit municipal broadband networks. I think they could do something with, this gets really into the weeds, but pole attachment. So it would allow new networks easy access to telephone poles so they could set up internet access to people's homes. I do think, and this isn't much relief to people today, but one of the forecasts I've done in the letters, if you talk about in our publication, if you talk about 5G networks and next generation wireless networks, I do think there's a bright future, but 5 or 10 years down the road, for actually being able to get a cellular wireless internet connection in your house. So it's wireless, but the data fees or data caps go down so much and the speeds go up so much that it's on par to that. So I think if you look down the road, maybe they don't have to address it as much as they are now. But definitely, like you're saying today, the people don't have, they don't have much choice if you get to the really high speeds. I don't know how much people know speeds, but if you go to 25 megabits per second or 100 megabits per second, then you're sort of have one choice for the home.
Yeah, for us, it's really around 20 to 25 megabit per second. If you're at that level or above that you want to be at, you're down to one choice. And that's one of my fears with the net neutrality proposal is there's going to be these unintended consequences. So, say that you pass this and the FCC has these powers and you've got this just and reasonable language in here, which has to be hammered out. And at the same time, you're trying to promote more competition at that delivery level, the last mile level. And I could easily see happening is these smaller companies trying to make competitive gains within a market. The big guys, all they have to do is just throw a few high powered lawsuits at them and say, hey, they're not complying with the just and reasonable language. It's going to cost you $150 million just to settle. And they're dead. They're gone then. And now you've found it's an easy way to kill competition and be perfectly within the letter of the law.
Yeah, and one of the things I think that the FCC is arguing, some of the people on Chairman Wheeler's staff is sort of saying, we don't think there'll be unintended consequences And I guess it's sort of my job as a journalist to question that. And that's a hard thing to say, that because that's what the definition of unintended consequences. So don't worry about that. The other thing is that the way I understand it, if you have, like I said, they only picked a few of those Title II rules. If you have legal standing, you can go before the FCC and say, why didn't you do this rule or why didn't you do that rule? So they might have to go through all those rules that they decided not to use and then sort of make a legal justification on why we didn't use them. So that could sort of be an issue down the line for that. So I think that is the concern. And especially if there's no final decision, and if this is in court, I do think it does just pose a little bit of uncertainty for the time being. And then you're talking about, I personally think that eventually the stamp on this, the final say, will be when Congress passes some type of legislation, whether it's just specifically net neutrality or whether they update the Telecommunications Act wholesale.
Yep. Yep.
But who knows when that would be, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I keep running through my mind, you know, some of the unintended consequences or unexpected consequences for some of this. And I agree with you. I don't think, especially with legislation that is this far reaching, that they can really expect to understand what the impact's going to be well enough to know that there won't be. And some of the language that I've heard about, maybe you can correct me if I'm mistaken, is things that are going to restrict things like usage charging to customers, and that you couldn't be charged based on the amount of bandwidth that you consume, but would have to be paying for plan levels as they do now, or that also too would restrict things like out of the box sort of ideas of having a phone which is a low cost phone and you have access to the internet but only specific apps like Facebook,
yep.
Twitter and, whatever. That would not be allowed under those new laws.
Yeah. So they would say there's no explicit rate regulation, but as you say, so they're not setting prices, but as you say, they have a just and reasonable standard in there. And what you're talking about when people get, if you have a T-Mobile service and you can get Pandora unlimited. So Pandora is actually paying T-Mobile for your data. So no content is being blocked or slowed, but when you use that one app, you have unlimited service. So I can't really gauge what they're saying yet. I know now it will be under the FCC's purview to rule on that. I think it seems like they're going to allow that, but they might not. And I think that's the concern of some of the wireless networks. And I would say, applying net neutrality to wireless cellular networks is probably going to be the trickiest legal thing they're trying to do.
Yeah.
I think that will be, and I think if you talk to engineers, I think it drives them a little nuts the way it's talked about in by policy people and lawyers. Because if you're an engineer, you want the networks to be super snappy or else you can't have a voice conversation.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really work. If you're talking about a real-time virtual reality application, it doesn't really work. You have to, it would be called prioritizing data packets. So you would have to have, you wouldn't be able to treat all the data equally for those to work. So when you apply this policy statement, it gets really confusing when you start to talk to engineers about how they're actually building their network.
Well, yeah, and that is something that I've brought up on here as well. Having actually worked in telecom myself and having created voice networks, one of the very first things you have to do is you have to ensure quality of service for your voice. And, that is a prioritization scheme. And I honestly don't know how that would be treated under these laws. Is that considered, because you're prioritizing a voice packet over, say, a streaming YouTube packet or whatever, or a download or an email, is that then in violation of that just and reasonable? Is that it's really tough to It's really tough to sort out. I also ran across, now I know this is certainly from a not from an unbiased source at all. It's from the Progressive Policy Institute. But they had a really interesting article that they had put through talking about how a lot of the information and the language in here really, really isn't even necessary. That they're talking about Section 706, which already provides protection against special deals for priority delivery and degrading a website's performance for refusing to take a priority offering. That's both of those remedies are already available under Section 706, and for that reason, this kind of it just doesn't need it.
The new rules, like you're mentioning, would have so you could do reasonable network management, but again, it's going to be under the purview of the FCC on what that is. So I think, like you said, there is some uncertainty there.
Yeah. Now I've been talking the whole time. I know Dave has got to be just chomping at the bit, because Dave, you and I have kind of, I don't want to say we haven't gotten into it, but we've had a difference of opinion on this many times. How do you feel about this now, Dave? What kind of leaning do you have about it?
Well, early on we had our disagreements, I think, but once you listened to me for a little while, you were convinced I was right. I'm glad it's being addressed, frankly, and I hope and I just hope the right answers come from it, because the telecoms and the cable companies have just kind of run roughshod over not so much the internet at this point, but in terms of providing service, they're constantly charging more for less and less service. I would just hope that and net neutrality is not really about that so much. It's just that everybody gets an equal shot at the bandwidth, and that it's not distorted or increased or decreased depending on rates that are paid. So I hope that the spirit of that's maintained as this process goes forward for regulation.
I think everyone is sort of in the same place anyways, that we all know that, there's potential for problems. There's a need for, a confidence in our internet, in our bandwidth, and that we are able to have access to it, that it's not being done poorly or done, not necessarily maliciously, but let's say avariciously, that avarice doesn't take the place of, freedom of access. And in that sense, I think I agree with the idea of keeping it, classifying it as a utility. I just worry so much about the way that it's put in place and all those unintended consequences. It's really difficult for me to kind of get behind 100% what the FCC is doing right now.
I agree with that completely. And by the way, I wasn't chomping at the bit to jump in. I was just really sitting on the edge of my seat enjoying the conversation between you two.
Yeah, well, outstanding. And I got to say, John, I'm going to have to pull us to a close here, but this has been fascinating. I put this as one of our best shows, just because it's something that I have been so fascinated by and so interested in. And as I said, I believe is going to impact people no matter where they're at, in ways that they can't even imagine right now. We're already adding money to our fees with increase in the E-rate stuff. That's going to impact people and they don't even know it. Putting more and more onto this bucket is something that we should be aware of. We should know about it, and we should understand how it's happening. I think listeners are a little closer to understanding what's really going on now in the giant sausage factory that we call government at the U.S. and whether they're ready to eat that net neutrality sausage, I don't know. But
great.
Oh, but John, but like I said, John, I do apologize. I do have to bring us to a close. We're right at the end of the hour here. I've got Rob Rigel with Rob Shot First, and continuing the Geek Block, 2 hours of science talk here coming up in just a moment. But John, We gotta bring you back on again soon. This has been great. I just love the level of expertise that you're bringing to us here. Sorely needed on the show. And where can people go if they want to find more great stuff like this with the Kiplinger letter and the other things going on with Kiplinger?
Sure. I think the best place is just kiplinger.com.
Excellent. And I know they can follow you at John T. Miley on Twitter also, and I am a follower. So we'll leave it at that. And thanks again. Have a wonderful rest of your weekend and a great week.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks, John.
Take care, John. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
John Miley from Kiplinger. Oh, man. Holy cow.
That was pithy.
Yes. Yeah. We nailed it down. I think that's it. We're done. We understand now. I know everything there is to know about. They should just elect me to FCC chairman or John. You know what? I'll vote for John. I think that's better. We'll vote for John for FCC chairman for next round. And that's right. We don't get to vote for that. That's an appointed position, isn't it? Gosh, yeah, darn
yeah,
it.
Yeah. You got to be a relative of the Secretary of Defense or something. So, but great points were raised, and like you said, it's a tricky the different. We're constrained by some of the other regulations, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. No, there's a tremendous number of things that are going on, you know, behind the scenes, and things are changing all the time, and it's a highly convoluted but also interlocked system of legality and rules and laws and policies and departments and everything else. You know, I threw in that little snippet about E-rate, and a lot of people don't realize. I mean, there's good things happening with E-rate, and I'm very excited about it. E-rate is a funding system that taxes our telecom. There's a little bit of money taken out of every single one of your cell phone bills and every single one of your telephone bills that goes to the government in order to support internet access and telecom access for schools, primarily K-12 and other nonprofit bodies such as libraries and things like this. And they're changing the way that that's working. They're getting more money involved in that. They're focusing more on the bandwidth and Wi-Fi side of it as opposed to the telephone and hosting a website kind of thing, which is great. I think it's a great move. But again, these are things that affect us in many, many different ways, and we have to be aware of them. So conversations like this is, you know, that's what it's all about. This has been good stuff. Good stuff. And on that note, I got to run. Rob's right outside. He wants to go. I know.
Can't blame him. Bye, everybody.
I know. Thanks, Dave. It was great talking. We'll talk next week.
Take care.
Bye. Bye. Dave Sparky Saganaki. All right, man. This is awesome, man. I'm putting this one up on this is like classics, Tech Talk classics. So I'm going to leave us right now with a little song called Tongue Tied by Group Love. And we got, as I said, Rob shot first. Rob Rigel is on deck and ready to go, so do not turn that dial. Don't forget, though, you can always get more Tech Talk at facebook.com/techtalkwrlr or go to techtalkwrlr.com. That'll take you right there, too, right over to our podcast page, and you can download stuff all the time. Hey, one quick shout-out to a longtime listener, a good friend of the show, Ken, was having difficulties with listening to us through his phone through the wrlr.fm link, and I wanted to let you know that you can actually get to us through TuneIn Radio. So if you haven't installed TuneIn Radio on your phone yet, now's a good time to do it. Then you can listen to us anytime, anywhere, wherever you are, as long as we're gone. So have a great day, everyone. You have been listening to Tech Talk on WRLR 98.3 LPFM in Round Lake Heights, Illinois. And I am flipping you over to, as I said, Tongue Tied by Group Love. Have a great week, everyone.